This week on the In-Depth Podcast, YouTube and social media superstar Logan Paul.
Look at us. This is f***ing therapy.
The influencer shares how he developed a love for content creation.
I found out that you could capture a moment that happened in real life on a screen. I was captivated. That was all it took.
And how his creative process has evolved over time.
I think it was such a new medium that suited our very rudimentary storytelling and comedy at that point in time better than YouTube. 6-second looping videos, anyone can do that.
Despite his short career, the professional wrestler has faced many highs.
After Floyd, somehow I felt personally like I just achieved something I had wanted to my whole life, you know?
And lows.
Like, do you know what it's like to be the most hated person on the planet? Because I do.
He also reflects on the importance of family.
Priorities shift depending on where people are at in their lives, you know? And I notice mine shifting. Family is making its way up the ladder.
And the roots of his strong work ethic.
Because my dad had been putting us in these like grueling environments ever since we were young. And I was working that hard on something I didn't love. So when I found something that I loved, no way anyone's gonna stop me.
Which has allowed him to achieve incredible success and wealth.
I want Prime to be a household name, you know, a lifestyle legacy brand.
All towards the pursuit of his ultimate goal.
Become the greatest entertainer on the planet.
This episode was unlike anything we've done so far at In Depth. We at most have a few days with the guest, but for this one, we spent 5 months with Logan as he granted us unprecedented access into his world. I hope you enjoy my chat with Logan Paul.
So is there anything that you're not expecting me to ask you about that I should?
I have no f***ing idea, bro.
I asked that question of Mike.
Not expecting you to ask.
I asked Mike, Mac, your mom, and Jeff if there's anything they never heard you talk about before.
Really?
In an interview that I should bring up. So I actually got a couple good stories on that front, but I think I'm going to save those for later.
Okay, yeah. Okay. I was like, Dad, dude, they're the people to get you some intel. Holy smokes, dude. This is
although,
in depth.
Although I was told to ask about when you went to Pennsylvania on a Bluetooth beer run.
Oh, you're going to take me back, huh? That was fun.
Actually, you can tell me that and then we'll get going.
Yeah, that was fun. We were 18 years old, seniors in high school, and our one friend, Brian Guzik, was doing like a pilot internship in Pittsburgh. And the four of us drove down there and we wanted beer one night. And I didn't drink at all, but...
Because yeah. You were kind of a like goody two-shoes.
Yeah, I was goody two-shoes. Yeah. And then... I don't know why. I think we played like rock, paper, scissors to see who was going to be the one to go get the beer.
Yeah.
At the liquor store in Pittsburgh. And it was me. And so we put like, this is what we thought being an adult looked like. We put like a Bluetooth headset on and like a polo. And I tucked my shirt in with a belt. And I went in and attempted to get beer to like 3 liquor stores and it never worked.
Did they all shut you down?
They all shut me down. Yeah. that's a lame story. It's funny to reminisce about the first time I tried to get alcohol illegally and it didn't work. We never got it.
All right. So I want to start actually by talking to you about,
I actually want to start because there's a bit of an issue here.
Okay.
I understand that we both have the same good side.
Oh, do we?
I got to sit on that side, Graham. I got to sit on that side because this is my good side, bro.
You don't have a good side.
I swear to God, I do. I'm like a ogre on this side. And this side, I look more like Jake Paul's brother.
I don't think there's much of a difference. In fact, that camera is actually shooting both sides, which was the issue I had with it a moment ago.
What, this one?
Yeah. So there's not, like, it's kind of shooting.
So you're unwilling to switch sides with me?
We can sit on the same side.
No, that will this whole beautiful setup.
Actually, the issue I have with this side too, I only cross my leg this way. And so then the sole of your foot, I can't like cross my leg this way comfortably. And so I always have my leg crossed this way with the notes.
You beat me in this game of rock, paper, scissors, I'm gonna have to talk like this.
I think you look cute.
All right, Graham.
I like that it's stressing you out as much as the angles stress me out.
Are you glued to sitting on that side? Please, Graham, it's my one ask.
Really?
Please. You can leave it up to chance. You made a pouty face.
If you start asking questions, you might forget.
I won't forget, Graham. I'll never forget.
If it's really important to you?
How important is it to you?
I mean, this is just the way we always... I'm always on this side.
I feel like people take me more serious when I sit on that side.
Shut the
swear
up.
To God. You think I'm joking. I swear to God. You know why? Because I can do this with my eyebrow on this side.
Yeah, but that captures it.
No. Because I'll be looking at you like this. I'm far less expressive and harder to read. I just look like a cyborg.
Wait, do
like
it again.
Like a cyborg jackass. Like a f***ing cyborg jackass mutt. Just one game.
One game?
One game. And I'll shut the f*** up and we can continue. But if you lose, we are switching sides. Just one game.
All right, fine.
Ready? Rock, paper, scissors, shoot. All right.
Oh, there we go.
You won.
Gosh, the amount of stress that just relieved is extraordinary.
You won.
I already
won.
Don't.
Fair and square, Graham. Carry on.
I think you were f***ing with me all along.
I wasn't. I was. I swear to God.
WWE.
Sure.
In what ways would you say that's kind of the culmination of your life's work?
WWE is like the perfect concoction for everything I've ever done. Like every skill set that I've garnered over my, 18 years of being a dirty little professional media slut has given me some sort of skill that I can portray in the WWE.
Did you hear that when Triple H first heard that you were interested in the WWE that he left?
Yeah, he told me to my face. I'm sure he thought, there's no way this internet kid can hang with the toughness and very complex nature of this sport. I think I'm much more capable than people think. I'm pretty f***ing capable, dude. Especially when it comes to physicality and toughness. I work my ass off and I can endure a lot.
Right, and I was gonna say, because it's not just physicality and toughness, it's work ethic. And that's what seemed to be clear quickly to everybody in the WWE.
Yeah, no. I'm gonna fly one. I'm gonna make this fly. I didn't get it. Can you give me a fly swatter? I'm gonna kill this thing. I will murder this.
You have a fly swatter here?
For motherfuckers like this.
Oh, that's no joke. You really do.
Carry on. Oh, that he's on you, bro. He's on you. He landed on you.
I know.
I want you to know I'm not gonna spare you.
I could tell.
This thing shocks.
It goes. Yeah, I'm definitely aware. So now you're hoping it lands on me.
All right, carry on. Sorry.
So you underestimated wrestling's difficulty.
Yeah.
How so?
Yeah. It is the hardest thing I've ever done. I've just never had to think about using so many skills at once. It's so hard. Like, you don't, it's not only about the physicality, it's about your memory, it's about the showmanship, it's about involving the crowd, it's about telling a story. It's like I said, everything I've ever learned, storytelling, physicality, toughness, memorization, just sheer capability.
And you said showmanship takes precedence over the moves.
100%.
How so?
If the audience doesn't care about your performance, you've lost. You have to draw them in. You have to get these people to care.
And the mic skills, that's something that you're like actively working on because that makes you a little uncomfortable?
I'm not super comfortable on the mic yet because I've found that I'm pretty good at being myself. I'm not good so much at reading lines that have been given to me. Does that make sense?
Yeah, sure. But that's interesting because, I mean, while I know you decided you didn't want to be an actor years ago, you know, played a handful of roles, you went to acting class for a number of years. I think I would have thought that you'd be more comfortable with that.
No, so that's how I discovered, like, I am not good at being anyone other than me. I'm just not. Like, I'm good at being me. And when I wanted to be an actor in Hollywood the first couple of years I was there, I worked really hard at being the best actor I could be. I went to multiple improv schools, multiple acting schools, and audition drill circuits every single week. Auditioned for a shitload of movies and stuff. And I just don't have it, bro. I really don't. I'm not an actor. I'm me. And in the WWE, I just have to find a crossover that works, where I can be myself on the mic, you know?
Where are you in that process now?
Every event I do, I can feel myself getting a little better. It's just believing that you are that person, you know? Like, I know who I am as a creator. I know who I am as a partner, as a brother, as a friend. I don't really know who I am in front of 20,000 people yet. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
That's f***ing hard, bro. You're like trying to convey some information, and there's a bunch of people watching you. And sometimes the information isn't something that's coming from here. It's given to you by the writer 5 minutes before you go on stage. That's difficult.
Do you get nervous?
Yeah, I do.
And how does that, like, when you're nervous, how does that come out in you?
I shell up a little bit.
And that means what?
I kind of go inward. I'm a little quiet. I'm reserved. It's hard to talk to me. I'm on edge. But it's so interesting because, like, I get nervous to go speak on the mic in WWE, but absolutely no nerves for the performance. Like zero. Just pure excitement, you know? I'm so comfortable physically in the WWE, but being that showman, that entertainer, which is the thing I've wanted to do my whole life, is the harder part for me.
Most positive feedback that you've ever gotten before, I understand, from your work in the WWE?
It's just entertainment on the grandest stage that is almost guaranteed to make you jump out of your seat every time. It's undeniable that when I'm on that stage, people pay the attention. Like, I put asses in seats, I put eyeballs on the television, and it's because I'm good.
How has your body changed over the years from, you know, the work you put in?
Yeah, I'm a late bloomer. I went through puberty much later than all my friends. I was the last one. In fact, they called me Shrimp in high school. So I was used to being the small guy. And then all of a sudden I have these muscles and I'm 6'2", and my body had caught up with just my natural, like, boy athleticism.
Yeah.
I think I'm very blessed genetically to be able to do what I love. My mom was a very good gymnast, and I inherited some of those genes.
And the athletic ability in your heritage doesn't even stop there. I think Don Meredith, of, you know, the NFL legend, was a relative.
Yeah.
Your mom's dad's dad, your great grandpa played pro football.
Yeah.
So.
No. Yeah. No. You've done your research. So, my mom's side was like fast twitch, body torque, lengthy athleticism, and my dad's side was like the muscular physique side. And in this weird world, it just created these two monsters named Jake and Logan Paul.
Ever use steroids?
What the f***? No, Graham.
Ever any other performance-enhancing drugs?
No.
I mean, that's a normal question, though. I mean,
no, for sure.
You're in an industry where it's not as if that's uncommon.
Yeah, for sure. No, so with boxing, you're drug tested, so we can't. And it would be, I think, silly to try to, like, do steroids in between there. But, like, I get why a wrestler or, like, an actor would do it if you didn't have anything else to do.
Mm-hmm.
But I've always prided myself on being as natural as I can be and pushing yourself. I get asked this question all the time, especially when I get into my routine, like 3 months into the workout regimen. Every single time people accuse me of being on steroids.
It'd be because you're chiseled as can be and...
Yeah, I mean, I don't f***ing know. I think it's hard for people to understand that someone can look like that without having to use steroids.
What does the diet and fitness regimen entail today?
Today?
Yeah.
It's not too healthy today. I
was going to say, I saw Popeyes in the...
Yeah, we had some Popeyes last night. Yeah. We had some Popeyes last night for sure. I do what I love, and that includes Popeyes.
But you go through periods where you're really focused on diet and fitness, and then other times when you're kind of...
Yeah, it's... I have like a mild version of ADHD, and if I'm not stimulated, I'm out. I am gonna move on to the next thing that stimulates me, including what I'm doing in my life. So if I'm not doing something in my life that excites me, I'm gonna find something that will. Mm-hmm. And sometimes eating healthy doesn't excite me. Popeyes excites me.
Hey, but eating healthy excites you when you're training for something?
For sure, yeah. Okay. I have a goal in mind, for sure. It's my whole life has always been about waves.
Uh-huh.
Ups and downs, switching the career path, riding it, swimming into it, running away from it.
So when you're training for WWE or a boxing match, how will you lock it down?
We'll do a regimented meal plan with healthy meals and a bedtime, a cutoff time for eating, a cutoff time for drinking. It's pretty boring. It's exactly what you can imagine. A very intense diet, a very intense regimen, and I just buckle down and do it.
Injuries. Take me through what happened in Saudi and where you stand now in the recovery process.
Yeah, I'm in really good shape. So, about halfway through the match in Saudi Arabia, I felt something just rip inside of my knee, and I had half a match to go through. And in my head, I'm imagining the moves that I have left, and like I didn't know how I was gonna finish the match. I didn't see in my head how I was gonna, this one move in particular, jump over the fucking top rope out of the ring and land on the Uso brothers. Like I didn't, and off my plant leg, my right leg, which is now in shambles, let alone jump from the fucking rope to the table. Like I just didn't think I was gonna be able to finish the match. And there's one part where I was stomping, and every stomp, I could just feel it rip more and more. But everyone's looking at me, bro.
By the way, I love how you mid-match at some point, you go over and tell your manager, Jeff, and your guys that are in the front row, and they all have like smiles on their faces, yeah. If like they don't understand what actually is going on.
Yeah, I told them I tore it, yeah. Mid-match.
And what's so funny about the WWE is you have to fake being hurt, but then if you actually get hurt, you need to act like you aren't.
It's the most absurd thing ever. It's all backwards. If you take a big bump that really hurts, and you actually tear some stuff, you have to finish the match. You can't quit. You have to act like you're okay. And then if you are okay, you have to sell like you're hurt so people believe the performance. It's a fascinating backwards world.
So what did the doctor determine was actually wrong?
Grade 3 MCL tear, which was truly probably best case scenario.
Yeah.
Almost a complete tear, but not. And MCLs recover themselves. It's about a 6 to 8 week recovery. As of today, I'm 4 weeks out and I'm probably 70%.
Wow.
Yeah.
How many concussions do you think you've had?
3.
And the doctor has told you what with regards to how you should act because of those concussions?
They beg me not to continue boxing, pleading with me, please, this is what they do, please do not continue boxing. Please, they made me promise.
And what do they say will happen if you do?
I mean, I turn my brain into putty, dude.
Oh, come on, I mean, if they really said that, that has to be enough reason for pause to like not do it again,
no,
right?
No, bro, they're medical professionals and they're f***ing dweebs, bro. Like, no offense, guys, thank you for taking care of me, but I can't stop doing what I love just because there's a little bit of risk. That's ridiculous. What kind of life is that?
So it's not guaranteed to do that to you. It's just,
yeah, no, it's dangerous. It's dangerous. Yeah. It's risky, dude. Mm-hmm. It's risky. My brother and I have pretty healthy young brains, and we are continuously putting ourselves in an environment where we're getting battered in the head.
Right.
In fact, my brain is my best asset. If something happens to this, I'm f***ed. And I don't just like say that nonchalantly. I'm f***ed. So I have to be careful with it. My boxing career is not going to be as long as my brother's. No f***ing way. It's dangerous. And I know that.
Have you noticed any impact the concussions having even present day?
You know, a tiny bit.
Like what?
Sometimes it's harder to remember or connect thoughts than I remember it being in the past.
Like, give me an example.
Just trying to collect thoughts or like remember something specific that happened in the past. Like, I don't know if it's because I do a lot and I forget a lot, which is probably partially true, but also like, I did notice that after I started boxing on the podcast, it was a little harder to speak and make cohesive sentences. But when I stopped boxing, my brains are very regenerative. Like when I'm in camp, podcasts are harder for sure.
Yeah.
Getting hit in the head's not, like, can't be healthy.
Right. And brains are very regenerative,
yeah,
until they aren't.
Exactly.
So you're entering the eighth grade. It's August 24th. You're getting ready to jump from a small trampoline onto the larger trampoline.
Yeah.
Take it from there.
I was running at full speed towards a small trampoline that was right next to a big trampoline. You jump from one to another.
In your dad's backyard.
We do it all the time. I know it sounds unsafe. We do it all the time. I was probably going around 18 miles an hour. I was at a full sprint racing my buddy to be the last one on the trampoline. There's a 4-person limit, Graham. Everyone knows that. I'm gonna be number 4. My foot gets hooked under the small trampoline and the momentum catapults me and I hit my head right here on the rail of the big trampoline. I fall to the ground. In the process, I break my wrist and got a 7-millimeter skull fracture, and they insert a titanium plate the size of a quarter with 5 screws in me dome, which I have to this day. And it was the first time I had experienced like real, real adversity in terms of injury anyway. Like I'm 12 years old and I have a metal plate in my head. I'm eating food out of a fucking straw. And ever since then I've continued to get pretty drastically injured every year. I mean, 7 millimeters isn't much, right? Like a skull fracture, probably about that big, but how much more could it have gone before my skull hit my brain?
Yeah.
And if the impact was an inch towards my temple, does a 12-year-old survive that? I don't know. I could have died. I was very close to like perishing that day.
I understand World of Warcraft and magic became very important to you during the recovery.
Very important to me.
Okay, elaborate on that.
I'm obsessive. Like when I find something I like, I dive in 100%. And since I couldn't do anything, I was just this 12-year-old little vegetable kid who had all these dreams of being this professional athlete, and now I can't do anything. I'm laid in bed. I started playing World of Warcraft and I started taking up magic. And these two hobbies became such an addiction for me. I spent thousands of dollars on magic trying to impress my friends. And then when I wasn't doing magic, I'd be playing World of Warcraft. Like, I'm supposed to be outside, you know, throwing the football with the boys. And here I am stuck on my computer shooting fireballs at orcs in the woods with my level 70 gnome mage named Slaber.
First time I'd ever seen the sunrise because I was playing World of Warcraft.
Do you remember when you came back wrestling with the helmet?
Yeah, of course, of course, of course. So that was the first sport I was allowed back. So I wanted to be a professional football player. My life is over. A year later, I'm allowed to wrestle again. I can do something great. They put me in this stupid-ass blue Power Ranger helmet, and I go to join the football team the next year. We're doing sprints, and I feel this pop in my knee. Turns out I tore a piece of cartilage the size of a quarter in my left knee, which is actually worse than an ACL tear because the cartilage doesn't grow back. It's gone. And I end up being laid up on this machine for like 4 months. It's like an automatic motion machine for your knee that you're supposed to use while you sleep that moves it for you. So for 4 months, dude, I'm 14 years old. My dreams of becoming a football player are crushed again. I can't sleep, and I'm addicted to World of Warcraft.
It really was a tough spot for you, though.
Dude, all my friends are doing what they want to do. I can't even go out of the house. I can't move. My leg is atrophying. To this day, it's skinnier than my right. Like injuries have ruined my life, bro.
How did it affect you at the time?
So this is actually where I started to create the version of me that was, in my head, unstoppable. At 14 years old, was so determined to come back stronger than anyone I knew. That was my mission in life. In fact, this is when I started manifesting.
And your mom, I believe, taught you and Jake about affirmations.
It was her, yeah. She taught us about this book called The Secret, and it was just willing the reality that you want to exist into existence by your speech, right?
They read you're 15 years old, and what are you saying every morning and night in the mirror?
My mission was A, to be better, stronger, faster, and healthier than I was last year, and then B, be more successful than anyone I know. I don't know what that meant. I'm 15 years old. What is success even? What does success look like? But I don't know. I was on the couch, riddled with injury for 2-3 years of my life, addicted to this game, and I had to come out on the complete opposite side.
Your brother actually told me about how you guys didn't really have the best roadmap for relationships growing up. Your parents got divorced. I understand it was quite nasty. What made it that way?
I just don't see how my mom and my dad ever meshed energetically. That marriage, in my eyes, was destined for failure the moment they got engaged. I just don't, they're so different.
And you'd spend 1 week at your dad's house and another week at your mom's house, and you guys just went back and forth.
Yeah, we went back and forth. My dad was adamant about seeing us 50% of the time. As harsh as he is, he loves the out of us. My dad loves us so much, and I was able to ask him recently about his desire to be a father, and it turns out that's all he wanted to do his whole life. Like, the only thing Greg wanted was to be a dad. Now, as an adult, I get to have these candid conversations with my dad, like, what did you see in mom? How did you guys love each other? What did the positive part of your relationship look like? And I think they both connect on how free-spirited and fun they are. They're both a lot of fun. And my dad's a lot of fun. And I think my mom was raised in a really strict household, and dating Greg was the antithesis of that. She got to be free, she got to be herself. But my dad is also very intense. He's a really, really difficult human. He just is. I can put Greg Paul in a room. I could put my dad in most rooms with people, and by the end of it, I think people will have a problem with him. He's difficult. He's very f-ing difficult. If you do not agree with him or don't see something the way he sees it, I think it's hard for him to get on board with you as a human.
What do you think you learned from him about work ethic?
Everything. Everything. I attribute almost all of my success to my dad.
Why?
You can do anything with hard work. We'd be 10 years old working 12, 14 hour days renovating a house that my dad was working on for no pay. Our pay was Wendy's for lunch. And I remember at the time, like, I hated this. Scraping gunk out of corners, like 4 inches thick. I don't even know what they it is. And like, he put us through the ringer. Then all of a sudden, I'm 14 years old and I'm wrestling, and my ability to endure the 2-hour workout is much greater than everyone else's. I was working that hard on something I didn't love. So when I found something that I loved, no anyone's gonna stop me.
And I think he lives in pretty much solitude now at the ranch, one of your other properties.
This is strategic, Graham. I swear to God, strategic. I put Greg Paul in the center of a mountain basin away from everyone in society so it doesn't piss anyone off.
A place you own on 80-plus acres in California. How does he help you on the ranch now?
He's my groundskeeper, man. When we were young, my dad would joke. He'd say, you know, when you guys get older, you're gonna be rich and famous, and you're gonna buy me a plot of land, and I'll be the groundskeeper. I don't know what the f*** he meant. Then all of a sudden, I bought this ranch, and I was able to make our childhood dream come true. Probably one of my proudest things. Having my dad work for me at my ranch kind of salvaged our relationship.
Really?
Yeah, for sure.
Like, how so?
I have not always been the most communicative with either of my parents, but now there's a dialogue that has to occur and have a reason to communicate with his son.
You guys have spoken about how he was physical.
A little bit.
Like, what would he do?
You'll hear different stories from Jake and I. Jake's memory seems to include a bit more abuse, which I don't recall. I recall my dad being stern and a lot of projectiles. He loved to throw things, books, buckets, pens, like when we were loud and he was on the phone. There were a couple times, one time he like tossed me down a couple stairs, but it wasn't child abuse. It was more just like a really stern parenting. There are kids who have really been abused. Like, you know, really been abused. This was not us, dude. My dad is a very loving guy with a temper. Sometimes the temper would flare up, but he'd never do anything that was incredibly out of line.
And correct me if I'm wrong, but you guys were kind of locked out of the house 13 hours a day. And then what does yo-yo mean?
Yeah, yo-yo. Yo-yo means you're on your own. So we go, you know, Dad, what's for dinner? And he'd be like, it's a yo-yo night. You're on your own. Figure it out, kid. My mom's not a fucking angel either, bro. She's not. Like, she is. She's an angel. It's Pam. She's a sweetheart. But like, she made a fucking slew of errors as a mother, just like all mothers do.
Like what?
Dude, she threw me onto my bed once, and I was a kid and I bounced and my head hit the wall, and there's a dent in the wall where my head hit. But there's grace in this, because as an adult, I was able to have these candid conversations with my parents. And one time I asked my mom about the bed throwing incident, and she started crying. And she couldn't believe that she was in a spot in her life where she was okay with throwing her kid.
Your mom said, and this was, I mean, when she was telling me it, I thought it was kind of brutal. She said, you know, you haven't been home for the holidays in at least a couple of years. You didn't get her a Christmas present last year. And you aren't one to do something unless you have a motive, like a vlog, she said.
Yeah, I mean, in the past, I can't lie, that's been true. I haven't always prioritized family first, or second, or even third. Like, when I moved out to Hollywood, I was on a mission that I was sure as hell I was gonna complete, and no one was gonna get in my way. Not my family, not my enemies, not a girl. Like I was gonna do what I set out to do, and that was become the greatest entertainer on the planet. And in that, I think I lost sight of what was actually important in life. Do I regret it? No, but like they're my dad would and mom both would beg me to get on the phone with them. Like, it was hard to get me to talk to them, just because I didn't understand what we would talk about, right? I just catch them up on what's happening in my life. Well, you just saw that online. That was like the daily vlog. You know exactly what's happening in my life. Priorities shift depending on where people are at in their lives. I notice mine shifting. Family is making its way up the ladder for sure.
I've been told that you struggle with relationships that aren't transactional.
That's not true. I struggle with relationships that aren't mutually symbiotic. If you want to call that transactional, fine. but I struggle with relationships where one person is giving and one person is taking. I won't do that, no matter what. I think in any healthy relationship, both people are receiving. There's a give and a take that occurs on both sides that keeps a relationship energetically balanced. Most people give so they can feel something. It makes them feel good. Few people give without expectation in return. If you can live in that space, you're a decent human. I've not been good at giving in a way that the traditional human seeks for fulfillment, right? Like gifts to me, I don't get it. I have everything I want. Can you give me your time? That's plenty for me. Let me ask you this.
Yeah.
Since we're doing therapy.
Yeah, yeah.
Is that my fault?
Are we doing
this
therapy?
This is therapy, yes. Look at us. This is therapy. Is that my fault? Because when I was growing up,
yeah.
Do you know what my dad would get me for Christmas? Pop-Tarts, Pringles, and socks wrapped in newspaper. And he put it under a tree, and me, Jake, and him, and our dog, DOG, would open up our gifts every year. And they were the same every year. And guess what? Best Christmas of my life. Was f***ing unbelievable. Wouldn't change it for a thing.
Yeah.
Because it wasn't about the gifts. It was about the fact that we were together.
What role does Jake play in your life?
He's my equal and opposite. He's the yin to my yang. He's the antithesis of me and yet the same thing as me. When I have no one to talk to because of an unrelatable problem that only someone in my position would understand, I call Jake. I love the shit of him and I am overly blessed to be doing this thing called life with my brother by my side.
And it wasn't always that way for the two of you.
Yeah.
When was the relationship at its worst?
It would have to be YouTube circa 2017. That was a gnarly era for the Paul brothers.
How so?
We didn't like each other, and we showed our resent for each other through online content.
Tell about these diss tracks.
Bro. Jake and I were both vlogging at the time. It became really competitive. There was no one else putting up the same numbers that we put up. And he made a diss track about me one day. I rebutted with a diss track about him. I took his girl, bro. His ex-girlfriend. I got her in my video.
Well, and then not only that, you slept with her.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Jake and I may have differing stories here. He seemed to think they were girlfriend and boyfriend, but was unwilling to do it publicly, and she seemed to think that they were on like free terms or whatever. I talked to him about it, and he was okay with it. But he seemed to change his mind when it actually went down. I think Jake was way more hurt than he liked to let on. But that was the thing, that was the thing. I had this relationship with this girl, and so did he, and she became like the crux of the diss tracks.
So what was involved with repairing the relationship?
Jake basically called me up after that diss track and was like, hey dude, this has gone too far. And I think he noticed far before I did that it was headed towards a nasty, really nasty place.
Meaning like pretty soon there was gonna be no coming back from
yes.
The place.
And he told me that. He said, listen dude, we can ruin each other's lives right now or we can like cut the shit out and be brothers. Through a series of misfortune, Jake and I realized that at the end of the day, we will always have each other. And that will always remain true, as long as we're both here.
What do you think would actually happen if you and Jake boxed? Because a family does not want that, right?
No. No, my parents don't want us to box, and obviously not. But I'd win. He's done an amazing job with his career, but I would have beat every single fighter that he beat just the same. I often ask myself how Jake would do against Floyd. You know, I guess that's the only comparison, and I just don't see him making it out of 8 rounds.
Do you think you guys end up fighting?
No.
You don't think so?
No.
Why not?
If it's not for money, which we don't need, like, why would I do that?
Mm-hmm.
It's my brother. But then the answer would be, it'd be to do something that's never been done before and probably never will be done before, and that excites me. That would be one of the greatest boxing exhibitions of all time. There's so much history between Jake and I, and if there's anyone that knows how to tell a story that's going to get you roped in or make you care, it's him and I.
All right, here's one for you. Jake tells me he's actually smarter than you.
That's the dumbest f***ing thing I've ever heard in my life. That's really stupid. He did not say that.
Swear
this
on my life.
Why would he say that? He knows that's not even remotely true.
He says he's not going to beat around the bush.
Get the f*** out of here.
And even though, you got better grades than him in school, that he's smarter than you?
You know, I guess my rebuttal would be rooted in logic. What's the metric for that, you know? Like, what's the metric for intelligence? Is it the amount of money you made? Is it the amount of followers you have? Is it the amount of lives you've been able to change? Is it your IQ on paper? Is it how street smart you are? Like, I don't know. But like, let's put it to the test. I'll beat him in every single category.
You qualified for Mensa level?
Yeah.
And explain what that means.
I actually don't know what that means. I just know I qualified it. As far as I understand,
I'm really f***ing smart.
I believe Mensa is a IQ above like, what, 135? What do you know what it is? It's an IQ above 135.
Yeah. Oh, and what does Calc God mean?
Calc God, yeah. So when I was in high school, I I'm a nerd, dude. Make no mistake, I'm a f***ing nerd. And in high school, I loved calculus. I love math. I love numbers. I love analytics. I love logic. Mm-hmm. When things make sense, I'm a happy guy.
Yeah,
I got it. And I prided myself at how f***ing good I was at calculus. So I called myself the Calc God.
And the scholarship offers you got coming out of high school were what?
Full academic ride to college.
And to OU. You could have for sport as well, right?
I could have gone to a D3 college on a full ride for sports. But I was really good at school. I was very good at school. And I knew that, and I liked it more.
Take me through, if you could, the different verticals of your business.
As it stands, I think I have about 5 or 6 wings. You got Impulsive, the always on, every single week podcast, talking we're chatting dude. There's Maverick, so the clothing brand. That was built through the vlogs, which is probably the third wing, the media creation, the content creation wing. That is my YouTube channel, that is my Instagram, the TikTok. Let's put athletics into one basket, WWE and boxing. There's my artistic side, which I've been able to do in the later years of my 20s, photography with originals. And then the business building, Prime and Liquid Marketplace.
On the podcast front, Mike says he doesn't think you would be Logan Paul today if the podcast hadn't started when it did.
Absolutely not. It's one of my biggest blessings in my life. I think the ability for humans to sit down and have long-form conversations day after day after day is highly underrated. How much can you discover about yourself by just conversing, you know, with exceptional people? You learn so much, and then you learn a lot about yourself as well by just being able to articulate your thoughts.
Yeah.
And Impulsive has given me a forum where I can speak freely and people can understand why I am a little better.
The BLM speech that you gave.
I'm very proud of that.
Surprised by the extent to which it resonated?
It is the most important piece of media I've ever made in my life. That 3-minute BLM speech, I felt was the first thing I did that actually had a real life, real significant impact in how people act.
And that did what for you?
Just opened my eyes to the idea that I don't always have to be a fool to get at someone's attention.
Yeah.
You know? I don't know if, but prior to that video, I don't know if people heard me actually like say anything important.
Alex Jones, that was a few years ago.
Yeah.
If you were offered that today, would you still have him on?
No. That's a good example of someone we probably shouldn't have had on the show. He's a crazy conspiracy theorist, said a lot of f***ed up shit about Sandy Hook. We hadn't really had our moral constitution set yet, or our rules as to who we host. We learned more about ourselves. We got feedback from the audience. We got feedback from the platforms that we were on. And like, okay, there's a guideline that you probably should follow for best practices.
And that's what for you guys, you would
don't bring porn stars on your podcast if you want advertisers.
How well do you recall the first time you got a still photography camera at 8?
That was the beginning of my arc as a creator. Like, I think if you boil me down to the most basic version of who I am, you will always come back to creator. When I was 8 years old and I found out that you could capture a moment that happened in real life on a screen, I was captivated. That was all it took. So I have been taking stills for 2 years of flowers. I love taking pictures of flowers. That was like my thing. And I had been begging my dad for 2 years to get a camcorder, a video camera.
Yeah.
Finally, he got one, and I would record everything. I love the idea of documenting. I also think it's incredibly important. Like human brains are incredible machines, but at the end of the day, this like very feeble. You're not gonna remember most of the stuff that occurs in your life, but if you document and you capture, you can relive these moments forever, and I think that's really important. I love recording. And then this platform called YouTube comes out. My first video that I ever posted on YouTube was stunts, me doing stunts.
What was the moment that you guys realized the content that you were creating digitally was taking off?
It was on Vine. I was a failed YouTuber for 8 years. Like, I had been trying to do YouTube for 8 years.
And what was happening?
Nothing. 10,000 views. We had 4,000 subscribers after 8 years. And I was happy with that. That's a lot of people. But something about the short form content that took place on Vine was way more attractive to Jake and I than YouTube.
Why?
I think it was such a new medium that suited our very rudimentary storytelling and comedy at that point in time better than YouTube. 6 second looping videos, anyone can do that.
Convincing your parents to let you take the solo trip to New York, what was involved with that?
Yeah, I know, I had never been to New York. I'd never really been outside of Ohio. I was 18 years old, I don't know what the world is.
Yeah.
Like, and I'm gonna go to New York by myself to make videos with a stranger? On paper, it's odd.
Because you'd been invited by another big digital star.
Yeah, his name was Jerome Jarre, who worked with Gary Vee, just got involved in a circle of internet creators where collaboration and virality and ideas were spread, and next thing you know, I'm a Vine guy in college. I gained like 100,000 followers in 4 days on Vine, which was big. I went from like 400,000 to 500,000. And I got to learn from some of the best. And I found that I had found probably the thing that I would love to do in an ideal world. I'd love to make content and, you know, get paid to do that. But that's not real life, you know?
Like, that's what you're thinking.
Yeah, yeah. I gotta go get a job. I'm sitting in these economy classes and business classes and chemistry classes, like doing well, but just not having nearly as much fun. It wasn't as much fun to me. And I made the decision to take the leap, drop out of college with a 4.0. I took academics very seriously and pursue media.
What did your parents say when you told them you wanted to drop out?
They supported whatever decision I wanted to make. My parents have always been very supportive, and I think it's because they just believe in me.
What was that environment like where you're living in an apartment complex with a whole bunch of other top Vine creators?
It was incredible. I mean, it's like it's a creative environment where amplification is the next door. You know, I knock on my neighbor's door, we make a Vine, gets 10 million views, and I can do that again right away in the next 30 seconds.
Were you at all concerned for your success to translate to other platforms beyond the 6 second Vines?
I don't think concern is the right word. If there's a platform to be understood and media graces that platform, I'm gonna figure it out.
So even though at the time you had 8 years on YouTube, only 4,000 subscribers or whatever it was, you by the time Vine was starting to shut down, your confidence had changed where you knew, like, you got this.
For sure, for sure. I was getting better at my craft.
Yeah.
I was getting better at my craft. And after Vine, we would post our content on Facebook and Instagram, where things would go just as viral. And refining that short form storytelling became a really useful skill for me. Attention spans are so short nowadays, and I happen to be able to create within people's attention span. I could captivate and tell a story, a beginning, middle, and an end in 6 seconds. And then Instagram came out with 15 second video, and now you're making a 15 second video. Then you can you post even longer on Facebook. Now I can do 60 second sketches, and it's the same thing. I was able to practice media making on Vine and syndicate that everywhere else. because I had an engineering brain and I was gonna figure it out.
By the way, I was meaning to ask you this. Your best friend from childhood, Mac, pointed out that you didn't have a smartphone till your senior year of high school. And he says he thinks that caused your brain to develop differently.
For sure. I've never had social media as a consumer, as a user. I've only had social media to create and share my content. I would not use social media if it wasn't for, like, this. That's what I'm saying. I create for you. In the past.
And it's for you too, though, because you enjoy it.
I love it.
Yeah.
I love it. It's my outlet, for sure, for sure. Excuse me. In the past, I would make videos and you know, the judgment was the trophy.
Mm-hmm.
Do you like it? Do you not like it? That's going to affect me. Now, while I create, yes, for an audience, I'm much more interested in making stuff that makes me happy, you know?
How attentive are you to detail in terms of, like, the execution
Incredibly.
And timing of
Incredibly.
The content you create?
It's everything. I'm so thorough, scarily thorough.
And how so?
I just pay attention to every detail and movement and micro expression that exists, especially if it comes to something I'm trying to make. I think attention to detail is incredibly important. And ask my dad about that as well. He will see where I got it from.
Really?
Yeah. Being thorough, attention to detail. A lot of people don't give a
And which is so interesting then when you consider, you know, we were in Austin and I'm watching you shoot the YouTube video. I think I would have come into the day thinking, okay, this would all be planned out, you know, et cetera. And
yeah.
then you just show up and, I mean, wing it. But
yeah.
that's
yeah, no, we
that's
wing
how
it.
You, you know, have
yeah.
had most success in content creation.
Yeah, absolutely. What?
Which, you know, they're like almost contradictions.
Yeah, I know. So
yeah.
this, I mean, what you're describing is art. You're like, what you're trying to do right now is to explain a creative process. Good luck. And seriously,
yeah.
like that's so hard. Every creative does differently.
Right.
Like it's odd. It's weird. Sometimes I wing it. Sometimes it's planned in advance. Sometimes I give shit about the details. Sometimes the lack of attention to detail makes the piece. Everything's different, and trying to describe how each ABC is made is going to change depending on what it is.
I want to talk about Japan's suicide forest. I think you said 90% of your life you were putting on the internet at that time. What does that do to a person?
It completely shifts their moral compass and I think personal soundness. I was at a point in my life where I was willing to compromise every part of my character if it meant more attention on YouTube. Bro, I thought I was invincible. What's gonna happen to me?
Your then girlfriend
yeah.
gave you some sort of warning.
Yep.
What was that?
She said, your behavior right now is completely inappropriate. And if you keep this up, something horrifying and very bad is going to happen to you. You're gonna shoot yourself in the foot. 7 days later, I did.
What was the original plan for when you went to the suicide forest?
The original plan was to
what happened when you actually got
yeah,
there?
Yeah, I do have to preface this with, it's hard for me to rationalize any of the decisions I made back then, but I remember the original plan being trying to play on the haunted aspect of the forest. I seen it go viral on Facebook once. I saw a Vice documentary about it once. And I happened to be in Japan and I needed some content for the day. And so we got a bunch of camping equipment. We're gonna go camp out in the forest and pretend like it was haunted. We made the grave, irreversible decision to keep the camera recording and still act like a vlog idiot instead of being a human.
And you said deep down you knew what you were doing at the time was wrong?
I knew it was wrong. You don't go into a suicide forest with a video camera.
And one of the guys that you were with can even be heard on the video saying, like, let's shut off the cameras
yep.
and get out of here. What are you thinking when you're like in that mindset at the time?
I don't know, Graham. I don't know. I can't relate to that kid who decided to keep recording the version of me that existed then. I don't understand his actions.
But you know the headspace you were in, like back then.
Yeah, I know I was in a headspace of ego and invincibility, you know?
That New Year's Day, explain what you were doing then.
I mean, the vlog machine is just that. It's a machine. So it was post a video, on to the next. Mm-hmm. Don't even think about it. And it has to be that way. Making a 15-minute vlog every day for 460 days straight is not easy. Make a video, post it, move on. So we were shooting the next thing already. And then, you know, there's this global backlash occurring online that I thought it would go away. I don't even know. And then the gravity of what I had done started to really set in, and I realized I had made a really, really grotesque error.
And was there a moment where you realized that, oh, this is bigger than I thought?
I think when the video started to transcend YouTube and make like global headlines, the reality of that whole situation started to set in.
And you're thinking what at that time?
I didn't want to be canceled. I just didn't want to get in trouble. Like, I wanted to save face. My first reaction was like, no, why is this happening to me? And I didn't get it. I had the emotional wherewithal of a child.
You're a kid. You know, I mean, like, you're a kid with a big audience.
Yes, but man, like, how come every other 22-year-old knew that was wrong? What the f*** happened in my life where I thought that was okay? I can't sit here and rationalize it, like any of my behavior around that time. It was f***ed. I don't know how else to put it. It was
it bothers you now even talking about it?
Yeah, it's disgusting. It's f***ing disgusting, bro.
What about it worked you up?
I just feel f***ing bad, dude. I feel bad.
About?
The victim, his family. The kids on YouTube who had to see some shit like that, dude.
That flight home that you took,
yeah,
and then the meeting that followed, what was going on?
I just remember thinking like, this can't be happening. How is this happening? Why is this happening? There was a perfect storm of circumstance and where I was at personally that led to, you know, one of the largest like public cancellations in history. Do you know what it's like to be the most hated person on the planet? Cause I do. And that sucks.
And Jeff, your longtime manager,
yeah,
you almost fired him during that period, right?
Multiple times. Why the f*** would he let me do that? Where was my team? Where are my friends? Why did no one tell me to stop? No one.
Did you ever consider hurting yourself?
No. No. I've never been suicidal. I've never been chronically depressed. I've had bouts of some pretty dark times, but never to the point of suicide.
How did you get out of that period?
Attack, you know, attack life. I had to rediscover and change who I was because I didn't know how I got there. Like, where do you go when you're at rock bottom? Where do you do? There's no manual for that. So I just started trying shit. I just started trying shit that I thought would make me a better person. I got a girlfriend. I became vegan. I took a break from the internet. I took up boxing. I knew there was a fork in the road somewhere in my life, and I went down the wrong path, and I was deep down the wrong path. So I had to reverse engineer my decisions and find out who I was and why.
You call having gone through all of that like the biggest blessing of your life?
It took me 5 years to be able to say that.
Why do you think 5 years?
Character change, at least for me, doesn't occur overnight. I was able to take the necessary steps to become a decent human being. I learned so much from that incident, and I learned so much from the course correction that I took upon myself personally. And the journey of change has been a beautiful one for me. And I can sit here today pretty comfortable with myself and say that I love myself. And I haven't always been able to say that.
Inner circle. Who do you consult when making a decision, whatever
everyone,
they might be?
Everyone.
And who's everybody?
Jeff, my girl, Mike, Trey, sometimes more. I'm pretty candid. Like our team's really open. I have conversations about out in the open. I'll ask opinions. Like I clearly have not done well in the past deciding by myself. So like, let's get a brain trust of people who each have an opinion, weigh them, measure them, and then make a decision.
And you'll still ultimately do what you want to do, but that process helps you in just coming to an opinion?
For sure. I've this has been really hard as a creative, but separating my personal beliefs and attachment to an idea is tough.
You shared the same publicist with The Rock. Tell about the call you got.
Yeah. It was one of the saddest moments of my life. My publicist called me, and she was like, "Hey, Dwayne wants you to remove every picture and video that you've ever taken with him."
You guys collaborated?
Multiple, like 3-4 times. I had always considered us pretty friendly. I was disappointed in myself, right? Because I had let my hero down. And a guy who I respected and emulated a lot. And then I just wish I would have like gotten a call or something. And I was sad because I understood like you sleep in the bed you make, and I understood that I f***ed up royally. And so it was like a double whammy of disappointment in getting that call and that being his wish, and that I had put myself in a position where I let him down, you know?
And he reached out not too long ago.
Yeah, when I was in South Africa, This monkey took my prime. This video went crazy viral. Dwayne sent me a voice memo afterwards, and he was just laughing about the video. He's like, "Ha ha ha, monkey took my prime. That's funny, man. Hope you're doing well. Always wishing you success from a distance." And I was like, "Oh, it's just funny how that works."
Why didn't you respond?
I mean, if we boil it down, Graham, it's because of my ego, bro. It's like he hurt me at a time as a result of my actions, and I guess I just, you know what it was? Actually, f that. It's not an ego thing. You know what it was? That was a big moment in my life when I got that call from my publicist. That was the first time I cried, like really cried, after Japan, when I realized like, okay, holy I've let everyone down. I've let every single person down, including my hero. Time to fix this. But I couldn't just forget about that phone call. You know, how do you go from me being at like the lowest point in my life to, it's all good. That monkey took your prime video was funny. Yeah, thanks, man. Hey, what about when you blacklisted me from your life? I can't bridge that gap without some sort of conversation that's gonna need to take place in real life. But also, no, it doesn't, because like Dwayne doesn't give a fuck about me. He's the biggest movie star in the world. Why should he care? I made a mistake, and he doesn't want anything to do with me, and that's kosher. That's how it's going to be.
But obviously, if he didn't want anything to do with you, now he wouldn't have reached out.
Those are the dots I can't connect. Why? And why in that way? I don't know. I don't love talking about it, because like I don't like outing him like this. He's a great guy.
Yeah. He prevented his mom from suicide.
That's why, by the way. He had a personal experience. Yeah. That video affected him.
Yeah.
Very different than, you know, the average human.
Yeah.
And so I get it. I totally get it. And you know, time heals all wounds. And I'm sure we'll get to it.
You said one of the best decisions of your life was deciding to fight KSI.
Yeah.
Why?
KSI gave me a forum to begin my redemption arc. I don't know where I was gonna go after Japan. How do you come back from that? I had to fight my way back. Literally, I had to fight my way back. combat was the only way I was going to get out of that. And have people be willing to at least listen to me. I made this deplorable mistake, but give me 1 second to refresh myself, and then maybe open your mind a little bit and allow me to potentially be back into your life somehow.
And the fight in terms of pay-per-view draws was only marginally less than Canelo Triple G, which was one of the biggest fights of, you know, this generation.
Yeah.
Mike Tyson has spoke positively about you and Jake and the impact you guys are having on the sport. What's your perspective on boxing's embrace of the Paul brothers?
I think it's great. You know, we entered this territory without asking for permission, kind of just barreled over the traditional format and made as much noise as we could. And especially with Jake, like, I gotta commend the kid. He's flipping boxing on his head.
Jake said he was with you in Miami when you found out that Floyd was in fact happening. What do you remember from that Instagram post?
I think there's a video of my initial reaction somewhere. And I just remember thinking, if I can just survive with this guy, my life will be drastically different forever.
In what ways were you thinking?
I think my whole life I've craved respect, and I don't feel like I got that respect that I wanted from making media online. And I knew that if I could weather 8 rounds with Floyd Mayweather, you'd have to respect me. You know, like, you might not like me, but you have to respect me.
When Jake took his hat, was there any planning between the Paul camp and the, and what about between and Mayweather?
No. No, oh my God, no. Floyd was pissed, dude. Jake has not been without a security guard since that moment. I think Floyd's gonna try to kill Jake. Like, real threats in Miami. What the f*** do we know about Miami, bro? Floyd knows Miami. He's been around the block. He got goons who kill a man for $200.
And you were initially pissed off at Jake for doing that.
Yeah. Cause he told me he was gonna do it. I didn't think he was gonna do it. He did it. And I felt like Jake had put me in jeopardy. You know what I'm saying?
Why?
Because he's my little brother, I love him. Like, he took Floyd's hat, a skirmish breaks out, go to protect my little brother, and if I break my hand or get a concussion or get f***ed up by Floyd's guys a month before the biggest moment of my life, trying to save my little brother's ass, that's stupid.
In the locker room after that fight, you got really emotional.
Super.
What was it about that?
I think the juxtaposition that existed in my head from where I was post-Japan to where I was post-Mayweather was too hard for me to comprehend emotionally. Bro, my life was over. And then after Floyd, somehow I felt personally like I had done enough course correction and had worked my ass off, both physically and emotionally in a personal way. That I just achieved something I had wanted to my whole life, you know? That night I felt like I was one of the biggest entertainers on the planet, and I did it that night.
Now, he says if it wasn't an exhibition, he would have knocked you out in the first round. What do you think?
Floyd talks a lot. He worked harder than any of his championship fights for our fight. And in every press conference, he told everyone, I guarantee a knockout June 6th. The narrative changes after you can't get that knockout though, right? Oh, I would have done this, I would have done that. Well, guess what, Floyd? If I had another 2 rounds, I would have knocked his bitch ass out.
So I understand you're owed somewhere between millions to tens of millions by Floyd still.
Yeah, it's not that much.
Explain that.
It's between 1 and 3 million.
But I thought it depends on what comes of the lawsuit. Personally in, because that could stand to make it more.
Yeah, correct. It would probably be between 1 and 3.
Regardless.
Yeah, deals were done using my name and likeness where cash was paid out without me taking part and eating from the plate. And was done behind my back without my permission using everything I've built. And I believe I'm owed a piece of that. Actually, I am, contractually, yeah.
The likelihood you end up having to take him to court to get that is what?
50-50. 50-50. Lawsuits take forever, dude. I will say it's exciting that I finally get to sue someone. instead of being sued.
And your gut tells you what?
My gut tells me that he's going to pay me upwards of $2 million in one way or another.
I wanted to ask you about Jake's boxing.
Sure.
Any thoughts on just his boxing ability?
Yeah, you know what? You know what? He's pretty good. Jake's a pretty good boxer. He's better than I thought he was. And I realized it after Anderson. He's much tougher than I expected. Which I guess makes sense. Like, he wanted to be a Navy SEAL his whole life, and I thought it was like a joke. But he's really a tough kid. He's really tough. I think Jake wants to be world champ, which I find preposterous.
Do you?
I think it's good that he wants to be world champ. I just, like, I don't see how he's gonna do that.
Okay, why not?
He's not that good. He's good. He's not that good.
Do you think he has the capacity to get that good?
I do. If he devotes his life to this, I don't see why not.
You ever get nervous for him?
Yeah, real nervous. Way more nervous than my fights.
Oh, do you?
Yeah, for sure. I don't give a about my fights. But when my little brother's fighting, like, that's my blood, and I'm not in there to protect him. He got to do it himself.
What do you think of what he's done with female fighters?
I think it's so commendable and historic. It takes a disruptor to make the kind of attention and noise happen that he does. And I'm not sure female boxing would have gotten this surge that it's gotten without Jake. It wouldn't have. No one gave a about it. No one cared. Even the top dogs in the business were making no moves to actually make people care about female boxing. But that's what Jake Paul does. He makes you care.
Here's one for you. Thoughts on his desire to unionize UFC fighters?
I think it's incredible. I don't know why there wouldn't be a union for one of the hardest sports and occupations on the planet. Fighters are incredibly durable and go through so much, man. It's a furnace being a fighter. Like, hot a lot and hard. And Jake wants to do everything he can to help them earn the money that they should be making. So it's awesome.
So how does this one work? You are, you know, actively in talks with the UFC to partner with them, and you and Dana have a good relationship. Yet Jake and Dana hate each other.
Yeah. Yeah.
How does that dynamic work?
Yeah. So I had to make a decision a couple years back. That Jake's beefs were not my beefs, you know, because he creates beef with everyone. That's what he does, right? Like, he'll make a video about A, B, C, D, E, F, G, all the way to the end of the alphabet, saying whatever the f, pissing everyone off. He's the problem child. That's what he does. But that doesn't mean I have to change who I like and what I like.
Yeah.
Because my brother has undertaken this weird agenda to piss in the entire world off. I love Dana White and the UFC, and I have my whole life. And getting the opportunity to sponsor them with Prime is a dream come true. And because my brother has picked Dana White as the figurehead for his fighter pay movement, doesn't mean I have to, like, die on that hill with him.
So did you tell him about the talks you're having?
No. Do you want me to tell him on this program?
Sure.
When you guys come for Christmas?
Oh, that'd be amazing.
Live?
That'd be great.
He's going to be pissed, bro.
You really have not told him.
I have not told him.
And why not?
Because it's a hard conversation. Hey, man, I understand you're trying to take down the UFC and unionize the fighters, using Dana White as the vehicle to do so. But I'm actually partnering with them, and while you do that, I'm gonna be boosting them up and making sure that our product, and thus the UFC, gets the most viewership and exposure possible. Hey, but good luck, by the way. It's a hard conversation.
How do you think that's gonna go down?
I think he's gonna be pissed, because I'm already partnered with KSI, who he also hates. But this is what I'm saying. Hates everyone. He causes a problem with everyone. What about my journey? What about my life?
Yeah.
Bro, I like KSI. I think he's f***ing awesome. He's a great business guy, great creator, great boxer. What the f***? It's not my beef, bro. Figure your shit out. That's where Jake and I are yin and yang, bro. Like, I'm not here to make war with everyone, you know?
You said before, I've come to realize I'm a hopeless romantic.
Yeah.
And I may never find love. Explain that thinking.
Yeah. That's how I felt. That's really how I felt. I'm complex. I'm complicated. I have a chaotic lifestyle that is very hard to understand. I'm extremely unrelatable. I have a short attention span. I, in the past, thought I would just be hard to be with.
Do you think you are?
Yeah.
For all the mentioned reasons?
Yeah, I do. I think I'm a difficult person to be with, yeah. Nina would tell you the opposite, because she thinks I'm incredibly easy to be with, but I think that's probably why I'm with her.
You created a long list of what you were looking for in a partner, right?
Yeah, the girlfriend list.
What was on it?
Do you want to hear it?
Yeah, sure.
Ideal girlfriend qualities: wit, confidence, intelligence, opinionated, empathetic, self-aware, active listener, sexual deviant, talented, worldly / cultured, foresight, insightful, attractive, curious, and probably the most important one, not a f***ing lunatic.
Which you said you haven't mastered yourself.
What, being not a f***ing lunatic?
Yeah.
Oh, I'm a lunatic. I'm a hypocrite too. I'm half of this.
Okay, and a f***ing lunatic means what to you?
I'm really logical. So when things don't make sense, it's hard for me to understand. And a lunatic to me is someone who doesn't make f***ing sense. What are you saying? I don't understand how you connected these thoughts, or why you're upset about this thing, or why this has to be a passive aggressive day versus just talking through a situation. Like, I don't get it. Like,
tell about the first time you met Nina Agdal. I think it's the Hard Rock in New York City.
I was actually supposed to work with her for Originals. She's a model, and I thought I liked her eyes. I thought they were nice looking. And as a professional, I wanted to feature her in one of my photos. And we got to the 1 yard line on the contract, and it fell through. And so,
because she said you were too cheap with the offer.
Yeah, she said we were cheap with the offer. And we were. Fast forward, I think 6-7 months later, we're both being hired to walk the red carpet for the opening of the Hard Rock Hotel in New York. And I got a text from her agent. She's like, hey, I'm with Nina, we're upstairs. And in my head, I'm like, hey, like, I don't give a you blew me off for the project of my life. Like, figure it out. I'm downstairs. Have fun. And then Nina took her phone and was like, can you come upstairs? I broke my back and I'm 30. And I was like, okay, she's funny. I love a good, like, witty banter. So I walked upstairs, and I have not separated from this girl for 6-7 months now.
What do you think caused you guys to hit it off?
We're kind of the same person. We're just like perfect together. We get along, we get each other, we have so much fun, we listen, she makes sense to me. Like, I can understand her. I think she's incredible. She's one of the most amazing humans I've ever met, and I find myself very lucky to be with her. And I don't know if I've really felt like that before. She fulfilled all the list of qualities on my girlfriend list. I couldn't believe it. In my head, this was an unrealistic expectation. And then I would notice things about her that I loved even more that weren't on my list. So I started adding to my list. And it says, additionally, since I met Nina and she raised the bar, AKA wife qualities. So the list goes beyond just being a girlfriend now. Because, you know, eventually, I hope to settle down and share my life with someone.
And you started talking about having a family together?
Yeah,
and I mean, where you'd want to raise kids? And
we're shopping right now for a potential area to raise kids. I'm sure they'll be partially raised here and partially somewhere else.
How many kids?
3, 2 boys and a girl.
And there's alignment on that?
Yeah, there's alignment on that. Dude, we're the same person. It's f***ing odd.
How well do you remember your first brand deal that you got and then your mom teaching you about taxes?
Very. This is a scary conversation. The first brand deal I ever got was for this product right here. It's called the Fly Grip.
Okay.
I got offered $2,000 to make a vine including the Fly Grip in my video back in 2014. I said $2,000 for a piece of content that I was gonna make anyways. Yeah, you mean $2,000, I'm rich now. Like, I'm rich, dude.
Yeah, right.
I just made $2,000. And one of my boys from college comes into my room and he goes, $2,000, huh? Well, good luck. You're gonna have to send like 700 of that to the government. I said, what? What are you talking about? My mom pays taxes. I'm 18. I just made $2,000. He goes, what are you talking about, bro? You have to give a portion of your money to the government because that's how taxes work. You need to tax on your income. So I call my mom. I go, yo, Ma, Sean is saying I have to give some of my money that I made to the government. She's like, yeah, you pay your taxes. Bro, I'm 18 years old, unable to compute how I didn't know about this.
So fast forward to where we are now at your place in Puerto Rico.
Yeah, I pay my taxes, Graham. Don't worry.
What did you learn about what Puerto Rico offered on that front?
The tax incentive program here is great. It's one of the best in the world.
What do you remember from what you first heard about that and then the process from that moment to actually moving here?
Yeah, I mean, it seemed ridiculous. It seemed ridiculous that someone would move to Puerto Rico to pay 4% taxes. Like, who does that? Weird. And yet here we are.
Because you were paying what in taxes before?
Like 50% plus in California, yeah.
You and Jake both relocated down here. This wasn't just overnight.
So Jake and I have always been pretty strategic. Jake and I were both done with California. I felt like I had gotten everything that I needed from Hollywood. I realized the amount of noise in these big cities, LA, New York, Miami. It's just temptation, it's distraction. I remember I had heard about this Puerto Rico thing a couple years ago from a buddy, and I was like, all right, I'm gonna go to Puerto Rico, just see what it's like. I came here and I fell in love with it. Jake was scouting in Miami at the time for houses. I called him, I'm like, hey dude, I'm driving around Puerto Rico right now, I really think you should check this out. Like, this place is beautiful. And then he came and we both fell in love with it. It was perfect for our lifestyle. No noise, no temptation, no distraction. We can lock ourselves away in a paradise for our 3-4 months boxing camp intensive. Like, I don't want to see anyone. I want to work out 4 or 5, 6 hours a day, hit my recovery, eat my meals, go to sleep, wake up, do it again. It was a change of lifestyle that I needed. It was very fitting for my lifestyle that is now that of athletics and locked in combat sports. And then, yeah, the tax incentive is just an incredible cherry on top.
What about Bad Bunny?
What about Bad Bunny?
I mean, he seems to have inserted himself in that conversation as well with regards to you guys, right?
Yeah, he has, man. The Bad Bunny has inserted himself in the conversation. And I don't know why. And I don't know why, because it's f***ed up. He has a f***ing Act 20.
Meaning he's benefiting.
He's taking advantage of the same tax law that the rest of the tax decree people are.
Yeah.
It's all online. It's government information. It blows my f***ing mind how people don't want to believe that. It became an issue when he put my face in a video that was like an anti-foreigner sentiment music video of his. Like, I don't understand. Like, I thought we were cool. Why are you making me like a poster child for a regime that you're a part of?
How's life changed since you've been living here?
I'm much happier living here.
Why?
I don't have gotta deal with bullshit, bro. I'm an introvert. I don't really like people. The more I got to know people, the more I didn't like people. I got my circle, got the people I love. If you're not in it, f*** off.
I want to talk to you about collecting. First, we see the dinosaur skull behind your head.
Prized possession. It's my prized possession, for sure. Number one buy.
Is it?
Yeah.
Didn't you have like an 8-foot leg at some point?
Yeah, I have a dinosaur leg as well. That was my first foray into dinosaur fossil collecting.
And Gary V got you into Pokemon?
Pokemon, yeah. I love Pokemon. I have since I was a kid. I played the games all growing up. I still play every now and then. I'll pick up a Game Boy Color and get addicted to it for a couple months. And Gary urged that I get into the TCG, the trading card game. When I can do something that I love, that is good for business and that I can make content out of, that's it.
Yeah.
That's my trifecta.
The most you've spent on a single card?
$5.2 million.
How about what you spent all in on Pokemon cards?
Probably like $7 million.
And correct me if I'm wrong, but you lost $3.5 million?
I got it back. I bought a sealed case of first edition boxes. They're the rarest kinds of Pokemon boxes that exist. And when we went to check the authenticity, and by the way, the reason I bought it was because an authentication company wrapped and sealed it, said this is real. That's why I bought it. It wasn't real, Graham. Being in that room was devastating. You saw $3 million get lost in 1 second and a man's entire business credibility get destroyed in 1 second. And you saw it all on camera.
How'd you get the money back?
I was lucky that the guy who was selling it to me is a homie and obviously wasn't gonna, like, it's a fake box. So he unfortunately is dealing with the legal repercussions of that.
How'd you get into NFTs?
I had heard about the idea of NFTs right around the time I started collecting Pokemon. And I just liked it. Like, I'd never been into crypto, but NFTs were a vehicle that I could understand to get into crypto.
Most you ever spent on a single NFT?
$623,000.
What do you think you put into it all in?
$2.5 million.
And what do you think that's worth today?
A couple bucks.
Really?
No, I was just kidding. But not a lot. Probably $500,000.
And what do you think that experience has taught you?
I've gotten the privilege of learning a lot about where to park your money. You know, I had a lot of money to play with and I spent it like a reckless 26-year-old. High-risk investments intrigued me and I did a lot of them and I lost a lot of them. But I won a lot of them too.
So going from collecting to creating your 99 Originals project, yeah. Take me through that.
Sure, yeah. So, I got to visit the first passion I ever had. Once again, it's still photography on a Polaroid. The idea of capturing a moment in time, something that doesn't exist, it's a moment in time, into a physical piece is really fun to me. And then stamping that on the blockchain and truly having that piece live forever was even more fun. So I found a medium, NFTs and collecting, that really worked for my artistic output. I traveled 84,000 miles in 99 days and tried to take as many Polaroids as I could. I ended with 99 finals and then sold them one by one, auction style, on the blockchain over a period of 99 days. The project grossed, I think, like $4 million. We have a group called the Originals DAO now that decides what to do with the money. And it's set the foundation up really nicely for me to continue any artistic pursuits I want to as I get older. Because I get bored of I'm not going to be boxing forever. I'm not going to be doing WWE forever. But I'll definitely be creating forever, for sure. And that medium, my canvas, will change.
Explain Liquid Marketplace.
Liquid Marketplace, okay. What it is fractional ownership. Fractional ownership. So if you want to be a collector and you can't maybe afford an original or a Triceratops skull, you can buy a little piece of it if you believe in the Triceratops skull market, right? And then trade and buy and sell and trade your pieces with other members.
In the long-term goal with that, what?
I'm not sure I have a goal for that. In my head, I think there's a spot in the market where it works. You know, if I was a kid at home, and I was 15, 16 years old, and I can't afford $500,000 Triceratops skull, but I think the dino market's cool. Like, yeah, I'll own a little piece of it. Or even my Pokemon card that I bought, the $5.2 million Pokemon card. That's insane to buy it outright. But if you want to own a little piece of it because you believe in where that illustrator is going, you can now do so.
Consider yourself a role model?
Do I?
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess I do now. Have I wanted to be one? Always no. But I have to be now. So, like, I guess, like, whatever. Fine.
And why do you say you have to be?
Because, like, it's undeniable that children and young people are watching my stuff and are going to look to me as some sort of example. You know, it was after Japan that I realized that whether I liked it or not, I was a role model.
Was that something that you initially embraced, or even like listening to you talk about it a moment ago? It seems like you're kind of a little reluctant when...
I'm reluctant to call myself a role model. But that's the position I'm in, no matter how you look at it.
So there, okay, that's fair, because there's a distinction between calling yourself a model yeah, and knowing that that's the position.
Do you think at any point in my career, I stood on a pedestal and said, do as I do. I'm the quintessential human who's got everything figured out and this is how it shall be. No, dog, I was like, I am discovering everything with you in real time for the entire world to watch and judge, including myself. I'm 27 years old now, and only this year have I finally realized who the fuck I am.
And so what is it about this year, though? What did you learn?
I stopped living for everyone else. Think about it, bro. This whole conversation, I've been talking about how my media dreams have existed since I was 8 years old. Mm-hmm. I've been making for you since I was 8 years old, and at 26, I decided to create for me. And in that, I found out so much about myself and about what I love and what makes me happy and how I feel fulfilled and what makes me, at the end of the day, go, I feel accomplished.
And that's what for you?
I think it's just happiness, dude. I think my number one priority is my happiness and my peace of mind. And if I don't have that, I'm not gonna do anything else. That would take a back seat 5 years ago. I would do anything for views. I would do anything for clout. I would do anything to make my audience happy, you know? And now if I'm not mentally right, I'm not gonna move for anyone else but me and the people I love.
Your goals today would be what?
It's a really hard question, man. And I don't know how to answer this because I'm so goal oriented. And for the first time in my life, I'm not sure I have a goal. Which is interesting because for the first time in my life that I don't have a goal, this year has yielded the most success I've ever felt. It's a bit backwards. I'm not sure what the is going on, Graham.
I was gonna say, why do you think?
I think it's because I stopped chasing. While it is a beautiful thing to look at the top of a mountain and say, I want to go there, it's also a beautiful thing to feel like you've climbed that mountain when you're still at the bottom of it. And you're so happy and confident and fulfilled with who you are and what you're doing in your life that you don't feel like you've fallen short because of a mission. And I've laid a really good foundation. I've laid a really good foundation for success in my late 20s.
When we were talking about doing this, you thought it was important and liked the idea of doing it now, at this point in your life. Why?
I feel like I'm about to catch my stride. Like in a big way. Young adult. Made a lot of mistakes, learned from them, made a lot of good decisions, and kind of have an idea of what I'm capable of doing and how I'm capable of doing the things. I'm very comfortable with who I am now. And I think I'm doing a lot of stuff that may prove to be pretty significant in years to come. And I think it's cool that you guys are along for the ride. Like the vision that I see for myself and for the entities that I built. And if this is the first place to capture all of it, I think it's f-ing cool. I want to have a sick WWE run, you know? I want to be one of the best foreigners in the WWE space to come into the company and disrupt it. I want my matches to be remembered for the rest of time. And hopefully I have a pretty entertaining arc in the WWE. I want Prime to be a household name, you know, a lifestyle legacy brand. I want to be doing Impulsive for the rest of my life. You know, I want to be at the table with my friends and guests that are exceptional human beings talking about interesting stuff. Like I'm warming up. I'm warming up. I'm simmering. And it's cool to capture this moment.
Agreed.
Thanks, bro.
Thanks a lot for listening to my interview with Logan Paul. To see the full special episode and clips from our 5 months with Logan, from Austin to Puerto Rico to Cleveland to LA, head to youtube.com/GrahamBensinger. And if you have time, please leave us a rating and review. Thanks again for listening.